Okay, we're just about to start the class. Good day to everybody. Hope everybody's well. And we'll be going just in about a few minutes. I'll just do a brief audio check to make sure that everybody can hear the audio all right. Once you hear the audio, just type audio OK at the bottom of your screen. And we hope everyone's doing well today. We're going to take up again and continue of our previous classes on the Rambam, the Maimonides, fundamentals of the Torah. So we're continuing in chapter 1, law number 6. That's what we're going to be picking up today. Again, so once you hear the audio, just type audio OK at the bottom of the screen. It'll just confirm that you can hear the audio fine. Okay, Jack and Goshen, good to see you. Have some no names with audio OK. Thank you for the confirmation. Cal in Washington, nice to see you. Hope you can hear the sound. If you could hear it, just type audio OK. OK, Hannah, thank you. And again, if you want to work from the text, we're using Maimonides' Mishneh Torah, the laws of the fundamentals of the Torah, chapter 1, and we're up to law 6. We'll just do a brief overview just so we have the context in mind as we continue. And then we'll also have a question and answer period at certain intervals during the class. Okay, Shmuel and Jack, how are you doing? Thanks. Gene, thank you. Okay, everybody else, once you hear the audio, just type audio OK at the bottom. Okay, Gene, thanks for the audio confirmation. Again, everybody else, once you hear the audio, please type audio OK at the bottom, and we'll start the class. And we're also going to do like a little activism today, which I'll explain shortly. Okay, Beryl in England, glad you could join us. I'm sorry, hope it's not too late for you. And Lou in New Jersey, Missy in New Jersey, and Don, if you could just type in audio okay, as well as James, Rabbi Eliezer, anybody else is joining us today. We just do a brief audio check before we start the class. Okay, Rabbi Eliezer, thanks for the audio confirmation. Okay, if you did not type in yet, just type in audio OK at the bottom of your screen. If you hadn't done so yet, make sure that we can get confirmation that the audio is going through fine. It looks like it's OK at this point. Okay, so why don't we start? Now, just to refresh what we were discussing in the Rambam's principles, the fundamentals of the Torah. So, of course, he starts out with the principle that it is the fundamental of all fundamentals and the pillar of all sciences, that there is a first cause, a Matsui Rishon, a first cause. Okay, Missy, thank you. Gedalia, thank you very much. Okay, so Rambam, Maimonides, says that we must know that this is the fundamental principle and also the pillar of all sciences. And what we explained last time was that there are two areas. Sciences apply to the created universe. Science is only something which applies to the study of God's knowledge in the physical world. But the physical world did not always exist. So you can't just say that knowledge of God is the pillar of all wisdom, because if there was no physical world, there would still be an importance to knowledge of God. And that would be what the first statement he says. That is the fundamental of all fundamentals. I mean, the most primary of all truths is that there exists a first cause, and that being God. Now, the reason why he talks about God in the framework of being a first cause is because once you have a first cause, meaning a first existence that was not preceded by anything else, I'll put the question to you now. Let's start out with the question for all of you, since we do this class in an interactive manner. What follows naturally when we say that God is the first cause, that nothing preceded him? What must follow naturally from that? So I'm opening the floor to all of you now. If you have a possibility, type it in. And again, please just type in your comments and questions when I prompt you to do so. Otherwise, I'm not looking at the screen. I don't want to miss any of your questions or your statements. So, but when I prompt you to respond to something, then I will be looking. This way, I'll be able to see all of your questions. Okay, so the question we have right now, well, let me just address Don. He seems to have no audio. Let me just take care of Don for a second and just make a message to him. But again, the question I'm positing to everybody is, why is it that Maimonides states that the first piece of knowledge we must have is that God is the first cause? What would follow from that knowledge? So now I'm asking all of you, if you have a possibility, you can feel free to type it in at the bottom of the screen. All right, so the question is, why is this the first statement that, and what is so fundamental about knowing that God is being defined as the first cause? Why does Maimonides refer to God in that, of all different ways? He can call him the creator. No, he calls him the first cause. Why does he call God the first cause? That's the question right now for you. Okay, so I'm going to wait and see what you type on the screen, and then I'll address. And if you have any questions at this point, you can ask them too. Okay, Yelra in New York, thanks for the confirmation. Okay, Kyle, that he always existed. Okay, true. There's something else too, Cal. Is that Cal as in Doug? Cal, I'm just wondering if that's the same Cal in Washington that I had seen when you visited out here with Doug. Let me know if that's you. Hope everything is well if that is. Lewis in Illinois, okay. Okay, Gedalia is writing, creating a void so that the universe can enter, since God is infinite. Creating a void. That doesn't make sense to me, Gedalia. You can't create a void. Creation is of a positive. And if you're trying to suggest that God has to make room for the world, then you're equating God to the physical world somehow. You're saying that he has to shrink himself a bit, which is a false idea that a lot of Jews, unfortunately, do have. There is a principle out there that a lot of people talk about called tzimtzum, or contraction, that God had to contract himself in order to make room, so to speak, for the world. But that is real heresy, because what you're saying is that God is occupying some space that was necessary for the physical world to occupy. So God had to make some room, so to speak. But then you're saying that God is physical in some respect, and that's something which is against reason, and it's against Judaism, so we can't say that. Okay. Gene is suggesting that nothing can exist independently of the Creator. True. Okay, good. That's something which we went into last time, Gene. That's right. Good to see you again, Gene, by the way. Shmuel in Massachusetts. All of the existence is dependent on the first cause, God. Okay, good. Everything else must come from him. Right. Meaning when you say that God is the first cause, that means that everything else came because of him. Okay. Now explain that. That would be a good thing to explain now, Shmuel. Why does it follow that if God is the first, that everything else came because of him? How does it follow? Okay, Rabbi Eliezer is asking, is there an implication that there is a second? No, when we say first here, we don't mean a first in a series. It means something which was never preceded. Okay? Okay, Cal, I'm glad that is you. I hope everything is well. Okay, in regards to Doug. Doug, I guess you can hear me also. Hope you're doing well. Good to see you both. And just as a sidebar, Doug, we'll probably be doing an email just in terms of your book. I don't know how many people that are online right now are familiar, but Doug is the author of a very, very fine book, very insightful and enjoyable book called Getting It Straight, which we sell here on the site. You'll see the links on the left-hand side of our site right now. You can take a look, and there's a link that's a store. It's about 7 or 8 links up from the bottom, and we are selling a book for Doug and Rabbi Moskowitz, which is a good book. We'll also be doing an email, Doug, exclusively for that book, hopefully in the near future, just to give a little push for it. And a lot of people really enjoy it. And we'll probably be starting to insert those articles that you wrote from the beginning, because I think last week we had finished up the whole book. So this way I think we have a nice following now of people that are reading it. And we're going to do a second round of inserting those articles. Okay. Okay, so let's just go back now to the question. All right, so Doug and Callaghan, welcome. Hope that you enjoy the class. Any questions, feel free to type them in. All right, Nissim is here, Ray's from London, A. Rose, Don doesn't have audio. Okay, you're welcome, Carl, you're welcome, Doug. Okay. So the question we have right now is, why is it, we're going back to Shmuel's point, Shmuel made a statement that everything else is dependent on God's existence. Because of his first cause. The question is, why should that be? Why should it be that since we have a first cause, which is God, that this fact, that there is a first cause, that this is now this now teaches that all other existences owe their creation to that first cause. How do we make that step? That's the question we have right now. Right, so this is the question. Again, that's Maimonides' first statement. His first statement is that we have to know that there is a first cause. Now, once we say there's a first cause, from that statement itself, we will understand why everything else requires this cause for existence. I'm trying to make sure that everybody has the question. We're trying to understand why it must, by definition, why it must follow that once you have a first cause, that anything else that we find in existence owes its existence to that first cause, meaning God. Okay, A. Rose, thank you for the audio confirmation. Now, I would suggest, unless anybody has a question, if anybody has a possibility, type it in at this point. Again, the whole purpose of the class is really to think into the questions, to study the rabbis, especially the great thinkers like Maimonides, and to try to understand what he's getting at, because they didn't write in a way where they're just giving you facts, like a history book or a documentation of some sort. They're writing in a way to prod our thinking. They're giving us the bare minimum in terms of information, cluing us towards, insight. He was writing in a way which mimics the way the Torah is written. The Torah is written in a way where you cannot contain all of God's knowledge in these few books. I don't care how many books. Limitation is something of the physical world, so there is no such limitation in regards to God. So a few books are not going to be able to contain God's infinite wisdom. So therefore, God wrote the Torah through Moses in a way where it's cryptic. And in this cryptic fashion, it trains our mind to become sharper. At the same time, it uncovers deeper truths every time we go through it. Okay, Lewis in Illinois is asking, is first cause and prime cause the same? Yes, we're using it synonymously here, Lewis. Okay, Michael, thanks for joining us today. All right, if you want everybody, perhaps everybody could type in okay, just to confirm that you hear the question. I want to make sure that everybody has the question before we move to the answer. So type in okay on your screen, provided you understand the question that we're dealing with. And then we'll proceed to some possibility of the answer. Okay, Gedalia, Jack, and Goshen. Lewis, all right. Cal, Doug, you guys have the question there? Nolan, tell me if you have the question too. All right, Shmuel. Well, Shmuel, it was your question. Of course you're going to write okay. Okay, just teasing. Gene, okay, very good. Cal, okay. Beryl in England, Ellie in Fort Lauderdale. All right, so it seems the question is clear. So what is it about God being the first cause? Meaning that there's a Motzoi Rishon, actually. The way really had to be clear, a Motzoi Rishon means to say a never-before-preceded existence. That's what we mean. So the way I would answer, okay, Cal. Cal is asking, can we repeat? Yeah, we're trying to understand, Cal. We're trying to understand the reason that the existence of a first existence would necessitate that everything else is caused by that first existence. What is it about there being an existence that was never preceded by anything else? So we're calling that God. So what is it about that truth that demands that everything else owes its existence to him? All right, and that is the statement of Maimonides. If you read it, he says, again, this is chapter 1, law 1, in the laws of the fundamentals of the Torah. He says that the fundamental of all fundamentals and the pillar of all wisdom is to know that there is a Motzoi Rishon. Okay, that there is a primary cause, something which always existed. And this is what caused everything that we find, all right? This is what caused everything that we find in the universe. And then he goes on and he concludes this first law and he says, and anything which is found in the heavens or the earth, or what's in between the heavens and earth, would not be found, would not be in existence, except for the truth of this first cause, except for the fact that God exists. Okay, so Cal, you're suggesting there would be no other possible source for anything else. No other possible source. Okay, what do you mean by that? You have to go further with that. What do you mean that there would be no other possible source for anything else? I mean, why can't we have that other things come into existence? And why can't we say that anything else has the same type of existence as God? Okay, so a thing cannot create itself. Right. Right. Agreed, of course. A thing cannot create itself, because if it created itself, it did nothing. And it's impossible to create yourself once you do exist. And at the point that you're not existing yet, then there's nothing else, there's nothing to do the act of creation. That's true. So what you're saying is that it would be that since there is a first cause, since there is something which precedes everything else, So when we say the first cause, that means there's a point in time where nothing existed except for God. That's what we're saying. Okay, so he's saying there's a point in time where there's nothing. Well, that everybody agrees, because we see the things come into existence. So once we know the things come into existence, we have to say that that which is effectuating the existence is that first infinite, always existing, we should say, always existing being. There's nothing else that can give existence to the object other than that first cause. Right, agreed. Right, Shmuel is making a another point that if other things could have the same existence as God, then Hashem would not be the first cause. Correct. And then God wouldn't have any distinct ability either. You would not say God is the creator if you say other things also shared in that. So by definition, we say that God is the first cause. That means everything else which is subsequent and didn't exist at a certain time, and now it does exist. Well, what brought this thing into existence? All right, so it's like Cal and Shmuel are saying. Right, so if there were no first cause, nothing could exist. And that's exactly, Cal, what Maimonides says in the next law. He says, if you could imagine the impossibility that God would not exist, but if you could imagine that, and you see, you know, Maimonides is very careful when he even talks about it, that it's such an impossibility that God should not exist. So that's what he talks about it that way. But if you would imagine that God would not exist, then nothing else could exist, because nothing else would have the ability, nothing has the ability to come into existence. What's going to effectuate all the matter? We look at the world, we see that there are properties, there are defined properties to every type of matter. By definition, when you see an object and it has a shape and it has a weight and it has a certain size, that means this object is different than that object. But what caused the distinction between these different parts of matter? There must be something which is governing the way object A exists and what's governing the difference between A and B. B has its own characteristics, a tree has certain properties, and water has different properties. What has delineated those properties? So there has to be something external to those things which caused it. Okay. All right. Gene is saying it is because the Creator does not need anything for his continued existence. That's another idea. That's not really part of this one, Gene. Okay. Ed in Canada is asking a side question. Could Judaism accept the idea of intelligent life on other planets? Not really part of the discussion here, but we'd have to see if there's any statements in the Torah or the rabbis that preclude that from happening. All right, that's something which is probably a pretty exhaustive study. So I can't really comment. But I would just say as a separate point that those people that are very interested in looking for alien life in the universe, it's always amusing to me, because even if they found alien life in the universe, wouldn't it be more amazing to find the creator of that alien life? And if that's really more amazing, so you don't even have to, you could skip that step, just look for the creator of human life. And that would be something which is the most amazing thing to encounter. And a person can do that. And that's basically why we're taking up this topic, Maimonides' fundamentals, because it deals with understanding clearly. We must have a clear understanding that God exists. Okay. There's more to be said on this. But it would take some study. So let's now go to what I wanted to take up now. Now that we just have the backdrop. So now we're dealing with the sixth law, because we did the other five laws. Actually, the other four we had done already. So we just did the first one again. And 2, 3, 4, and 5 we had done at the end of last month. And those are online. So in case you did miss any class, and you'd like to review those classes, you can go to our audio files link, which is the seventh link down from the top on the left of the screen. Okay, and again, just remind me if I forget, there's a little bit of activism that I'd like all of you to take part of today. We'll do that after we do the studying. Okay, so what is the law that Maimonides says now in 6? So it's the fundamentals of the Torah, chapter 1, law 6. And he reads as follows. I'm going to read it in English. I'll translate it as I go along. So Maimonides says as follows. Knowledge of this matter, meaning that God exists and he is one and he is the first, is a positive command, as it states in the Torah. I am God, your God. So that's not merely a statement, that's an imperative. That's a command, according to Maimonides. He counts that as one of the 613 positive commands, that you must know that God exists. Now, if that's true, that's requiring knowledge. So the idea that God is our God, meaning that there is one God and the first cause, if that's something which is part of the area of knowledge, then we must be able to prove it to ourselves. And that would be the way to fulfill that command, is to know. Because as Maimonides says, v'yediyas davarzeh, the knowledge of this is a positive command. And he goes on, and he says, and anyone who entertains on his mind that there is another God besides the real God, he violates a negative command, because it also states in the Torah, you shall not have other gods before me. So not only is it a positive command to know that God exists, but it's a there's a prohibition, which is also counted as one of the 613, that you should not have any other gods before me. And then this is an interesting statement at the end of this law. He says, and one who assumes that there are other gods besides God denies this ikr, this principle, this fundamental, because this is a great fundamental that everything depends on. Okay, so this is a great fundamental that everything depends on. So he says three statements here. Maimonides says it is a positive command to know that God exists. And anybody who entertains in his mind that there is a God outside of God, other than God, he transgresses a negative command, because it also says, don't have other gods before me. That's in the Ten Commandments. That's the second of the Ten Commandments. But not only that, the person violates a fundamental principle. And he says it's the great principle that everything depends on. Okay. So let's think about what he says here. There's a positive command that you must know God. So what does this tell us if there's a positive command? What this tells us is that when God gives a system of the Torah, he's giving those commands which work perfectly in line with reason. Meaning that's our primary distinction over all other creation, is that we have intelligence. Nothing else but the human beings has intelligence. Now, the engagement of that intelligence is clearly what the objective is in man's life, is to use this intelligence and to arrive at greater truths, and it's an enjoyable process. God also made the whole process a very enjoyable process. It's intriguing to hear a good question, and it's enjoyable to hear an answer, and then that propels us into even new questions, and it's an endless study and an endless pursuit. But they all have to be grounded in the foundation that there is a creator. But you see, when he makes a command, the command is something which is very capable of man fulfilling. That means that the commands of the Torah, we can derive from here, the commands of the Torah are perfectly in line with our nature. Because he says you must know this matter. The knowledge of this matter, that God exists and was the first cause, is a positive command. Because he says, v'yediyas davarzeh, the knowledge of this matter. What's the matter he's referring to? What he started out at the beginning. That there is a first cause, and that everything depends on him. So you must have knowledge of this, not belief. We're not talking about, there's no benefit of a person just, he can mouth something, but not have any conviction in his heart. He's not convinced of something is truth. So where's the benefit in the person's own system if he himself does not find that he is 100% convinced? He won't move himself to follow it in his life, but if a person does see something clearly, and his mind tells him, for example, you're hungry, you need to eat, the person will definitely get up and eat. He is convinced of that. But you don't need to have just physical sensations. You could have conviction in your mind as well that's equal to that type of a conviction. So that is something which we have to be able to arrive at. So God will not give a command if it's impossible to arrive at that command. That's why he further goes in, you'll see in the next law, and he explains, and he gives his reasoning as to how this must be. And that's what we started out talking about. We started out talking about why must it be, why is it necessitated that everything else owes its existence to the first cause? Because primarily that there is a first cause. There's not an endless series. It's impossible to have an endless series of causes. If there was no beginning, you'd never have a present. And it's impossible to be that there would be no beginning to all the physical causes and effects. And our mind tells us. So using our mind is really what we're obligated to do here. Okay. That's number one. Number one is to know that this is something which we can prove. It's not just a matter of demand. We shouldn't look at the Torah system as a system where it demands us just to have blind faith and to accept it. Well, why should we? The answer is, it's because the creator of the universe, who created the whole system of knowledge and cause and effect, everything that we see in terms of how the universe operates is precisely designed by this creator. Like we said, everything else which exists is due to his design. So when he designs us in a certain way, he designed us with the ability to tap into that very system of reason. So it's amazing, but true, that our mind works in line with how the external universe operates, and we can perceive and uncover wisdom, and that's how we have to go about doing it. Okay, the other command, we said, is that you should not have any other gods. You shouldn't accept that there are any other gods before God. And he says, if you, now that's a command as well. So you see again, you have another command, which is completely aligned with reason, to remove the fallacy that there is any other god. Now, what should a person do if he does feel there are other gods? Let's say a person has that disposition. I mean, we're children at a certain point, and we have superstitious notions and infantile ideas. And what are we supposed to do when we come across a command in the Torah that says, don't have any other gods? Okay, so you tell me now. This is the second question I'm now opening up to all of you. I'm asking everybody now to think about this and answer. If you have an answer, type it in. The question is, what should a person do if he's honest with himself and senses in himself an assumption that, yeah, maybe there is God, but maybe there's others. Who says that he's only one? What should a person do at this point? Okay, that's the question I'm asking you. Okay, if everybody has a question, just type in okay. Just confirm for me that you have the question clear. And the question is, what should a person do if he realizes, a person has to be honest with themselves. What should a person do if he thinks that that there is more than one God, or if he's not convinced that there's only one? Got a question again? This for A. Rose. Okay, Lewis, thank you for the confirmation. Okay, A. Rose, the question is, what should a person do if they sense in themselves an assumption that they feel that there is more than one God, or let's say that they feel that God doesn't exist, or if they feel that there's more than one, because Maimonides says it's a command that you should not assume that any other gods exists besides the true God. Okay, so Jack is suggesting probably explore the other divine possibility. Shmuel, why in Massachusetts says, seek out the traditional answers and Torah knowledge and see if that satisfies. Okay, Cal is suggesting, wouldn't it make sense to prove that it's impossible for more than one to exist? Excellent, exactly. That is what a person must do. A person must then disprove it logically. They have to show that it's impossible for more than one to exist. Meaning, if that's a command So that means God is telling you, when he says, not only do you have to know that I exist, but you must clearly exclude the possibility in your mind that any other God exists. Now, if God tells us that we must deny the fact that there could be any other God, that too must be something that is subject to reason, to proof. So therefore, a person should explore that, and they should uncover any other thought that they might have, that, and then show how it's a fallacy, how it's impossible. Anything which exists, we know, it goes back to the first argument that Maimonides gave. There is a initial cause that everything else came from. So using that reasoning hopefully answers it for most people. If not, a person has to explore further and see if they have arguments, let them, you know, voice their arguments. A. Rose is asking, if they have a question, doesn't that imply doubt? Yes, so a person should be honest if they're doubtful about something and explore it and attempt to completely refute anything which is false. You have to come to a determination. Either something is true or it's false. And in this area, this is not something simple. This is something which everything else is based on. And that's why Maimonides concludes this law and says that a person who assumes that there's other gods is somebody who denies the most fundamental of all principles. And he says, everything depends on this. What does it mean, everything depends on this? Well, the commentators on Maimonides state that, meaning everything that exists depends on God. So you can't tell me that there's something else which is a God also. If everything else exists because of God, that means God alone has the ability to create. If that's true, so there's no such thing as another God. There's only one God, one thing that which caused everything else. You can't tell me that there's two gods that caused the whole world. So then that means one god didn't create the other god. So there's something in existence which one of the gods didn't make. So you can't say there's two gods. Okay. Tsipalea, you're asking, is the only proof of God being that other religions believe in the event by Har Sinai? No, you can see here Maimonides uses reason himself. There's the philosophical proof that he's talking about over here. He doesn't even mention Sinai over here. Sinai is also a proof that that God exists. Okay, Lewis in Illinois is asking, if the commandment is that you shall not hold other gods before me, does that necessarily mean that God is the only God, but our God is the supreme God? No, that's not true. It doesn't mean to say that God is better than other gods. It means to say that, by definition, God means creator. If we had to define in the simplest terms for ourselves what we mean when we say God, we mean to say the creator of everything. And once you have one creator of everything, that's it. Everything else is subordinated. There's no lesser gods. There's only one cause, Lewis. All right, I hope that's clear. Let me know. But you see another interesting point. Besides the Torah having commands that you should know that God exists, meaning God's trying to benefit mankind and giving a book to Moses and passing it down to all the people, and in the book he's giving them the most primary directives that are for our own good. So, number one, know that God exists. Know for your mind that everything that you see in the world is created by God. Because the truth is, if you do not know that God exists, and you study the world, you become the best scientist, the bottom line is, you will not have a real understanding of what you study if it doesn't culminate in appreciation that this is created by a God. And if you just think everything always existed, or it came together by accident, like other people think. I mean, even scientists today agree. There was a big bang. There was a first cause. They don't go behind, you know, prior to that, because science stops at that point. But we have information not through science, but through prophecy. That's how we know. We have the Torah through prophecy. But reason itself can show us here that there is a cause that had to precede all others. But if you don't have this knowledge that God exists, so then your knowledge of whatever you see in the world is lacking greatly. You may know how to manipulate it better than anybody else. You can create the most fantastic solutions in a laboratory. But if you do not know that these things are created by God, your real knowledge about these things is lacking, because true knowledge is knowledge of the why this thing exists. Knowing why a chemical behaves a certain way is a property, but that property is only something you could talk about once you talk about the fact that there is a chemical in front of you. Meaning there's many aspects to anything physical. If we just take a liquid, for example, there's shape to the liquid, there's how it reacts with other elements and compounds, there's a weight to this liquid, there's temperature, there's behavioral patterns to it. But the most primary property of this liquid is that it is here, that it exists. Now, if the knowledge of how it exists is something which I don't have, it doesn't matter how much knowledge I have about the rest of it. Knowledge of the very existence is the most primary knowledge. And therefore, if you're lacking knowledge, there's a creator. That's what Maimonides concludes over here. And he says that everything depends on this. Not only does everything depend on God for its existence, but your knowledge of everything. Our purpose in life is knowledge. So if we are lacking knowledge of how this thing exists, then that's another acceptable explanation of what Maimonides means here, that everything depends, meaning all of our knowledge depends on knowledge of God. All right, that has to be clear. Okay, Tzipele, you're asking questions that are good, but they're peripheral. So I really would like to stick to the topic. If you want, we can take them up at a different time, or you can send an email in to the site, and this way it can be treated relatively quickly. So if you want, hold on to your question and just send it in as an email. Okay, I just don't want to go off the topic for now. Okay. All right, it looks like all the questions are clear at this point. Now, let me just pause for a second and just open the floor to you. All right, so we said a number of things at this point. There's a positive command, the negative commands. We said that the commands are something which are based on reason, and therefore, if you have false assumptions regarding these commands, you should explore them. You should uncover them and use your intelligence to prove that something is impossible or prove that it must be. Okay. A. Rose, you're asking something about humility and arrogance. I'm not sure what you're asking. And the last point we said in Maimonides is that he says not only are these commands, not only are these things that we must do. And again, keep in mind that we are created as well. So we should recognize the fact that we are created beings and that this God that created us is giving us commands. That should be something which we readily jump to right away. That should be the priority of our day. That should be the sense of it. We're put here, we're created, we're like a piece of molded clay. And we have to recognize that. And that's why it astonishes me when I hear people saying, well, yeah, God exists, but I'm not going to keep the Torah. It's just not for me. I mean, to me, it's just an amazing statement that a person just does not have a sense of the fact that he is created. He or she is a created entity. And now this thing which created you is giving you a directive that's for your own benefit anyway. So to rebel against it is just, it's just an amazing thing. Okay, but you see that Maimonides says it's not only a command to know that God exists. And it's not only a command to refute the idea that other gods exist, but he says it's also somebody is violating the very basic principle. Forget about the fact that it's a command, but he says it's a violation of the most fundamental principle in your life. Meaning to say, knowledge is inescapable. The world works by reason, and if you're going to deny this primary piece of information, you're going against the entire reality of how the world operates. Okay, so if you have any questions on this, feel free to type it in, and let me just go to the screen and see what questions we have so far. Okay, Eric said, Sipalea, you'll send me the email separately. I like the question, I just would like to treat it properly, and it would be a digression to treat it here. Okay. A. Rose, you're asking, does that mean humility as opposed to arrogance? Meaning, if you believe you are humble before God and not arrogant, that all is to be taken for granted. Well, nothing is to be taken for granted. I really don't know what you're saying here, A. Rose. Let me just see if I try to understand what you're saying. If you believe you are humble before God and not arrogant, that all is to be taken for granted. I don't know what you mean. Baruch is writing as follows: if the whole Torah was given at Har Sinai, does that mean that the Bnei Yisrael knew their future? No, we don't say the whole Torah was written, because that would be exactly like you're saying, Baruch. If God gave Moses the Torah and they knew about all the sins they were going to do in the future, what type of free will would they have? So you can't possibly say that the entire Torah. You could say, see, Rashi is the one that makes that statement. Ibn Ezra does not say that when it says, see, the statement in the Torah, that God says to Moses, come up to the mountain, I'm going to give you the two tablets of stone and the Torah and the mitzvah. Now that's openly stated at the end of Parshas Mishpatim. So what does it mean, and I'm going to give you the tables of stone and the Torah and the mitzvah? Are those three discrete physical entities? Well, according to Rashi, they are. Rashi holds that God gave Moses the two tablets of stone, and he gave him the scroll of the Torah, which could not have been in a completed form, and he also gave him the oral law. So the Torah means the written law, and the mitzvah means the oral law. According to Ibn Ezra, he says that all those are references to the tablets, meaning I'm going to give you the tablets, and I'm going to give you the Torah that's written on the tablets, and I'm going to give you the mitzvah, the commands that are written on the tablets. So you don't even have a unanimous view amongst the rabbis that the Torah per se was given at Sinai. And that was something which the rabbis say that this view is that, you know, that Moses wrote it down as, you know, time marched on. Okay. Okay, now let's just see if there's any questions on Maimonides. All right, so this is keeping to the subject matter. Is it clear? Do we understand that Maimonides is explaining to us the idea of command, and that it should be something which we use our minds to uncover, and that if we think that there are other gods, we must show that it is impossible. We should not be afraid to explore that area. We shouldn't try to lie to ourselves and say, no, I don't believe that, because lying to yourself is the worst thing. If you honestly feel that there's God, or that there's two gods, or the God is physical, these are things you have to explore and prove to yourself as being false. You can't not examine these areas. Okay, and again, we said the idea that God being first means that he preceded everything else. Everything else didn't exist at a certain point. So if it didn't exist, what caused it to exist? Well, there was only one thing in creation. So if we want to have it clear in our heads, how do we know that God caused everything to exist? We know that everything physical had to come into existence. It didn't make itself. Therefore, if it didn't make itself, there's only one thing which could have caused it, and that's that being which is not physical himself, because that was the only thing which existed before all the physical came into existence. Again, if we know that the physical world cannot create itself, so it had to be created by something external to itself. Therefore, there is a cause to the entire physical world. Okay. You'll see that what naturally follows is that a person might think, well, maybe there's two gods then. Fine, I agree there's a God, and I agree that he created the whole physical world. Well, maybe there's two gods. That's why Maimonides takes that up next. But let me just stop for a minute and see if there's any questions that you have. So let me just go to the screen. Okay. Okay, Baruch, again, it's a side question, but it's a quick one, so I'll answer you. You're asking what was included in the oral Torah that was given at Mount Sinai. All right, well, that was the Mishnah, primarily. Everything which the rabbis later on had taken up in the Talmud. So if you look at the Mishnah, and you remove the rabbi's statements from the Mishnah, so those basic concepts is what they received. Like, for example, it says in the Torah, in the written law, you should have tefillin, right? You should wear these tefillin, these totofos, on your head and on your arms. But where do you exactly place them? And what size are they? And what color are they? And what are they made from? So all of that is something which God gave to Moses in an oral fashion. Okay. A. Rose, okay, let's see if you can clarify for me what you're saying here. You mean to say that if you believe or try to understand, you are humbled before something greater than yourself. Okay, agreed. Meaning, if you're trying to understand God, then you're being humble. Right. Whereas if through arrogance you are blinded into thinking you know all, you take everything for granted. Okay, now I understand you. Yes, that's true. I understand, A. Rose. Exactly. Meaning if you try to learn during your life, then you're humble. You realize that there's a great amount of knowledge out there. And that's exactly what King Solomon said. The beginning of knowledge is fear of God. Only a person who fears God is going to have that mindset that he realizes there's so much to learn, and he will ask. But if a person's arrogant, then they won't. They think they know everything already, which is one of the biggest... the biggest acts of foolishness that a person could commit. Okay. Any other questions of what we discussed up to this point? Okay, looks like everything is clear. Just give one more minute, see if there's any other questions before we go further. Now, while we're on this topic, in terms of God being the only cause, I mentioned at the beginning that I wanted all of you to be involved in some sort of activism today. It came to my attention, somebody had sent me an email, that there's a website, and I'm sure you're all familiar with this fallacy, which is permeated a lot of very big stars and Judaism. I'm referring to this red bendel, the red string that many people wear, and they say it wards off this evil eye as if there's some power in the world besides God. Now, what happened is some website called Judaism.com is promoting this with a video, and they have these Jews in beards in Israel wrapping these red strings around the gravesite of the matriarch Rachel, and they say that this has some sort of a power. Now, it's clear that the Talmud says openly that red strings are the ways of the Amorite, meaning the idolatrous cultures used to do this. They were the ones who really originated wearing red strings on your hands. And they thought that this would have some power, like all other things that are idolatrous. But now you have a website called Judaism.com that is now claiming that this is a powerful thing and it has power. I mean, it's idolatrous and it's ridiculous, and it's something that everybody should really speak out against and demand that they take it off their site, because they're fooling people and they're trying to make money off of fooling people. They're selling these things, and there's other stores. I mean, there's a store in my neighborhood where there's a rabbi who runs a store and he sells these red strings. And I told him if he gets rid of them, I'll buy products in his store. But I have not stepped a foot back into a store, and I know that he's still selling them. Meaning this is something which is completely against the Torah. We're saying over here, clear in Maimonides right now, that God is the cause for everything. So God is the one who will punish a righteous person. He'll punish a wicked person, and he will give reward to a righteous person. Now, if a righteous person did not sin, and he's not wearing a red string, he's not wearing a red bendel on his wrist, God, therefore, is going to punish him because he's not doing it. That's ridiculous. And let's say you find a wicked person, but a wicked person that puts on the red string. So that's going to stop God from punishing him? I mean, it's nonsense, and it's hurting other people. Plus, they're doing it just for monetary gain. And you could look at the site yourself, or you could take my word. I looked at the video. It's not even worth your time to look at because it's just stupidities. And people are doing this in the name of Judaism, and that is the worst crime. So at the bottom of your screen right now, I'd like you all to take a moment. You'll see, there's a field where you type in your questions. To the right of that, you'll see red text, or at least it's red on my screen. It says there's a send box, there's an exit box. Again, I'm referring to the very bottom of your screen here where you type in the entries to the chat page here. You'll see it says receive schedule. Then it says invite others. The last link, it says activism. I'm asking all of you to click on that link that says activism, and it should open up an email box. It should automatically open up an email box, and there's a pre-formatted message that's going to go to that Judaism.com website. And I hope that if enough of us respond and tell them that we're going to boycott their site and we're going to tell others not to go to their website, that they're going to take it seriously. I mean, if you'll click on the activism link, you'll see the message that pops up. And it quotes the source that I just told you about. It's a Tosefta, meaning it's a commentary in the back of the Talmud Sabbath in the seventh chapter, and it says clearly that these red strings are the ways of the idolaters, and they are prohibited. And then it doesn't matter how many Jews are doing this. It's just a ridiculous type of a concept. I mean, you think about it. If a person, you got two people in front of you, one person's wearing a red string and one person's not. You could shoot both people, and they're both going to get penetrated by the bullet. The red string is not going to stop the bullet from entering your body. So it's not going to help you at all. And if a woman can't have children, and she puts on a red string on her wrist, there is no causal relationship between that red string and her becoming fertile. So it's a complete prohibition of the Torah. It's against God's will. And it does not matter that supposedly religious Jews are promoting and supporting this type of a nonsensical thing. So if you just take a moment now, click on the activism link on the bottom right of your screen. Send the email. Once you've done, maybe you just want to indicate it on screen that you've sent it. It's very important that we speak out and we see things that are very dangerous and mislead other people. Okay. So just take a moment and do that. So maybe what we'll do is there's one more law I'd like to do in Maimonides today. So just take care of that email. And if it's not opening up, when you click on the activism link, if it's not working on your PC, you can just send an email to info@judaism.com. And just tell them they should stop selling their red string. All right. Chana in Florida, you may have to open your screen wider. I'm not sure how big it is. But if you can't see it, Chana, just send an email to info@judaism.com. And just let them know that you're protesting and you're going to boycott their website until they stop selling the red string, and that you're going to tell other people also to boycott their site. It's completely against the Torah. Okay. All right, Gene, Shmuel, good, thanks. Chloe in Florida, thanks. Avraham, New York, good, appreciate it. Rabbi Eliezer, Larry K, good. Okay, A. Rose, feel free to look into it further. Look at the source that I quoted in the email. All right, enough people, send this out. I think this will make them worry, because since their bottom dollar is the dollar, that's why they're doing this. I want to sell them. So when they see that people are not going to stop buying them, or at least they may stop selling it for the wrong reason, but at least they won't be misleading other people. But I'd also ask you to now, if everybody listening now has an email list, I'm sure everybody has a list of their relatives or friends, copy out that email. If you want, you can click on that link again and copy out the email content, or you could, even better, you could probably click on that activism link one more time, and then when it opens up, maybe there's some way you can add recipients to the email. So besides, I'm not sure if the wording is going to be the same, but I would definitely suggest to tell all of your contacts to send an email also. Tell your contacts that they should write Info Judaism and say that they're boycotting their website because of the red bendel, and that they're going to tell others as well. It would be a good thing to get like a chain email going, because this way the letters that come in to Judaism.com will grow exponentially, and they'll start seeing that people are going to stop buying from them. So that's really the best power, is to really make and show them this is false. You can't just be silent when other people in the name of Judaism are saying such fallacy. I mean, there's only one cause. God created the world, and that's it. That's right here in the Rambam that we're doing. Okay. All right, so if you can, just, everybody that's listening, send an email to your entire list that you have on your phone, but your email, whatever program you use. Send an email to all of them saying that they should send an email to info@judaism.com. And basically with the sentiments that we're saying, that they're boycotting their site because of the red bendel. Very brief. So take a moment, do that now. No time like the present. And then we're going to continue a little bit further, and we'll do one last law in Maimonides. Okay, so take a moment now just to send that out. Okay, a rose, no problem. Okay, so we'll do the next law on the Rambam now. Let me just give me 1 minute. Just want to look at my notes. Okay. All right, once you're done sending it to your email list, just I guess you can let me know by just typing it on screen. Okay. And then I'll know that I'll continue with the next we'll do one more law in Maimonides. We'll probably just go for like another 15, 20 minutes. Yeah, that's true, Mitch. Mitch Menschel is writing that his wife remembers the red strings on baby carriages since childhood. Yeah, it goes back. Okay, Shmuel. Okay, Cal. Thank you. Cal, Doug, I didn't get any feedback from you on the plagiarism article that ran about 2 weeks ago in the Jewish Times. I hope you appreciated it. Okay, Gene, thank you. All right, so let's go a little further now in Maimonides. Now he's going to tackle the issue of God being one. And he says as follows. This God, now we're in Law 7, this God is one, and he's not two, and he's not more than two, except only one. But his oneness is not like any type of oneness that we find in the world. Okay, so this God is one, he's not two, he's not more than two, and his oneness, the oneness of God, is not similar to our concept of one that we find in the world. He goes on. It's not a oneness like a category, like one category that may have a lot of subcategories to it. And it's not one like a body that can be divided into many extremities, meaning the oneness of God, you have to be clear. When God says, "Listen, O Israel, I am God, I am one," when God says that He is one, what is this concept that God is imparting to us in the Torah? So He's saying you must be clear that again, we should know that there's no such concept of positive knowledge of God. We can't have anything positive in terms of our concept of God. The best we can do is negate false ideas in connection with God. So when we come across the statement in the Torah that God says that He is one, what we have to do is say that His oneness is not something we could know in a positive sense, but we can remove false ideas of one. Now, what's a false idea of one that when we say God is one, it can't be referring to X. Well, what's X? So he's saying the oneness of God can't be viewed like one body, like one physical substance. Because he says a physical substance can be divided into parts. You can take a rock and smash it into thousands of pieces. So when you say that it's one rock, that cannot be equated to God. Because you can't say that God can be divided into thousands of pieces. All right? So it can't be that. And Maimonides goes on. It says, "Lo echad k'min shu kol echadim." This is, but his oneness, she'ein yichud acher k'moso ba'olam. That his oneness is not comparable in our world. There's nothing in our world that's comparable to God's oneness. He goes on to say, if you would say there were many gods. Because he says at the outset, God is one and he's not more than one. Now, if you would say that he is more than one, how would you be able to say there's two gods? Now, let me just clarify what this means here. What it means is that if you had two gods and they did the exact same thing, how would you say that they are two? By what means would you distinguish one God from the other? If you said God A created the entire physical universe, and then you said God B created the entire physical universe, you're not talking about two different things. You're saying that it's the same thing. Like if I say that person A just went on a trip of all 50 states in a 1970 green pickup truck, with his two twin brothers, they were triplets, so named Jeff and John. Now, that is not going to apply to anybody except for this guy. So if this guy's name is Bob, and I say guy A took this trip with such specific parameters of the trip, and I say guy B did the same exact trip, so in fact, I'm really talking about the same person. So if you're going to do the same thing in connection with God, you're going to say that God A created the entire physical universe, and then you say God B created the entire physical universe, you're in fact talking about one God. So there's no distinction that you're making. So therefore, it's only one God. So you cannot say that there are two gods that created the whole universe. Okay, from that reasoning. Okay. The only way you could distinguish the two of them if they were physical somehow, Maimonides says. Okay? Okay, let me just pause for a second. Make sure that that's clear. That's a little bit of an abstract point. If you have the point, just type okay on screen before I go further. All right. Good, thank you. Now it goes on and he says, and it's interesting, the Maimonides is very good in his writing. He says, now if this Yotzer has a body, what does he mean the Yotzer? Yotzer means that reference to God that he formed the universe physically. When we have different appellations for God, the creator, the king, we also have the term the former, the one who forms everything. So it's interesting how Maimonides slips in that appellation here. He says, "V'ilu hoya hayotzer," and if this former had a body and extremities, he would have an end. Meaning to say, he's trying to show that he's the one that forms everything. So that the laws of there being a body to something don't apply to God. God is not subject to physical laws. He created the physical laws. So don't assume that he has physicality. For if he did, he would have an end to him. Because it's impossible that a physical body doesn't have a certain time frame, a certain duration. That would be impossible. Because everything that is physical has an end. Meaning to say, anything which is physical came into existence. God caused it to exist. Now, what does that mean that he caused it to exist? It means that it didn't have the properties of existence by itself. God had to add existence to this thing. So since God had to bring this thing into existence, that means in and of itself, It doesn't exist. It only exists because God willed that this thing exists. We only exist because God wills us to exist. But that means to say that there's a certain, that it's dependent on Him. So there can be an end to our existence also. Okay. But God, since He has no end to His power, as we see that He causes the spheres and the sun and the galaxies to constantly be spinning. Therefore, ein kocho koach guf. His power is not the power of a body. So you see that something which he's trying to make a principle here, that when you see a unrelenting force in nature, that has to emanate from God. It's impossible because any force comes to rest at a certain point. All right, there is a beginning, there's an end to it. But since we see that the universe is constantly moving, and what's causing the sun, what's causing the earth to constantly revolve around the sun? So this force is not coming from the earth itself. So there has to be something which causes this motion. And that's true about all of physical creation. And since God is not physical, he goes on and he says that we can finally come to a proof that he's not two, that God is not divisible, that he's not one like we know it. Because our idea of one is something which can be, you know, be divided into half, into pieces. We can break something in half that's still one. So we see our concept of one is only applicable to the physical world, but cannot be applied to God. But now he says that since God has no body, there did not occur to him the events that visit physical bodies in order that God might be separated or broken into parts. This does not apply to God since he's not physical. Therefore, it is impossible that it can be anything but one. But a true concept of one. Not the concept of one that we have, but he is an indivisible one. And he concludes this law and he says that knowledge of this principle is also a positive command, as it states, God, our God, God is one. Right? From the same statement, Shema. The famous Shema statement. Okay. So what he did here is now he went a step further and he showed how God is not more than one. Meaning we initially showed how God does exist and no other gods can exist. But now a person might think that, well, the concept I have of God, maybe he's divisible, maybe he's more than one in some way. Maybe he works with a group. Maybe he's divisible. So when we talk about God, it's important that we have the true concept of God. It's not just enough that we know that he created the world, but if we think that God created the world, he did it by himself, but we think that he is in some way divisible or physical or has any of the attributes of the physical world, then we have a false concept of God. So it's not only important, essential, that we know that he is the creator, and that there's no other cause for the existence of the universe, but even in terms of our concept of this creator, that has to be accurate. We have to remove and negate any false ideas that are in connection. Okay. All right, so I think what we'll do is we'll stop here in terms of the text that we're reading today. Let me see if there's any questions now. So if you have any questions on what we did today at any point, feel free to type them on screen. If there's any clarification you need, by all means, put it on screen. Okay, let me take a look. Chloe in Florida is saying, is Yotzer used as a word to go out? No. In this context. No, we're not saying Yotzar go out. Yotzer doesn't even mean go out. Yotzei means to go out. Come over. Okay, and you further ask, if God has no body, then how does one explain the sighting of the back of God's head when Moses was up in Mount Sinai? What about the tefillin? The tefillin? That's metaphoric. All right, Kamoi? When it says that Moses saw God's back, It doesn't say in the verses that he saw the back of God's head. That it does not say. It just says that he would see God's back. So that has to be studied. But it's not to be taken literal. And what it means that he saw God wearing tefillin or saw God praying, those are statements of the rabbis that are metaphoric. Okay, Baruch, you're asking, in the Ten Commandments it says that we should not serve other gods. But it never really says that there is only one God. Well, that's why Maimonides brings down the quote over here. It says in the Torah, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elkeinu, Hashem Echad. Listen, O Israel, God is our God, God is one. So God does say that in the Torah, Baruch. Now, when God says, I am a jealous God, it does not indicate that there are other real gods. What it does indicate is that if God says, I am jealous of other gods, it would mean to say, I am jealous of those imagined other gods. God's hand is also metaphoric. Yes, Michael. Again, keep in mind, if God created man, that means before man existed, there was no such thing as a hand. Because a hand is part of the creation of man. So prior to God creating the physical world, there was no such thing as physical. Yet, God existed. But the terms that the Torah uses and that the rabbis use are to indicate a concept. So when you say the Egyptians said it's the finger of God, or it's the Jews say they saw the hand of God, it means they saw the working, the actions, because a hand connotes activity. It also refers to that part of the person that would smite another person. The hand is what you use to smite somebody else. So when you see it was the hand of God, it means they saw God doing an act of smiting the Egyptians. There was no physical hand, of course. And Michael is asking, who decides what is and isn't metaphoric? Well, reason is the best guide in terms of determining this. But again, the rabbis themselves were unanimous in this. So our Torah comes from the rabbis, so that you will read them and they will tell you this as well. Okay, any other questions? Okay, Chloe, yes, the rabbis. The rabbis are the ones that are licensed by God, because God says in the Torah that in accordance with the Torah which they command you, and the judgment that they teach you, so you should do. All right, Gene is suggesting very well. The anthropomorphisms are really divine actions put into words humans can understand. Right. Okay, now Michael's asking a very good question. Did the handwriting on the wall in Daniel just appear? Now, that keep in mind, Michael, there was a real physical hand over there. Okay, so when Belshazzar saw the hand writing on the wall, he saw a real physical hand. However, that was not God's hand. God created a physical hand just like he creates physical people. And in this specific instance, God's knowledge decreed that it would be the best solution to Belshazzar's problem if he saw a hand writing something on a wall. It's not God's hand. It's a physical created hand. Okay. A. Roseman is saying, in a manner of speaking, are there veils that protect us from the power of the source that would annihilate us if we were to remove the veils protecting us? I don't know what you're talking about, protect us from power of the source, a source that would annihilate us. There is no source that has power in the existence except for God. So I don't know what you're speaking about, A. Rose. Okay, any other questions? I mean, it's very important that we do not have any concept of God in the physical sense. That's complete, it's heresy. It's blasphemy. That is something which is not found in any of the statements of the Torah, and when you do see something which seems to imply that, you have to know that it has to be understood in a metaphoric sense. Michael, no, it's not subjective. It works by very basic principles. I suggest, Michael, that you purchase Maimonides' book. It's called God for the Perplexed. He goes into this in his first book. It's divided into three books. The first book deals with anthropomorphisms. Baruch is saying, you skipped over my question. Why does Hashem allow the concept of multiple gods to exist in the world? Oh, I didn't see that question. I'm sorry, Baruch. You're asking, why does God allow the concept of multiple gods to exist in the world? Well, God allows people free will. God wants a person to come to conclusions on their own. Part of free will is going to be that people that are foolish will teach ideas like dualisms, and that there's more than one God. So God's not going to step in necessarily, and every single time a person makes a foolish statement, you know, to put tape on his mouth. That's not how God works. He wants a person to use his mind. All right? Someone is also asking, isn't it also the oral law from Sinai, not just the rabbis? Yes, that's true. Gene is asking, when is the next class? Please, soon. Okay, we'll try to do it soon. I know it's been a few weeks since we had the last class. Okay. All right. God is not out to annihilate us, A. Rose. You mentioned earlier, are there veils? I'm not sure where you get this from. You're saying that there are veils that protect us from the power of God. God who annihilate us if we were to remove the veils protecting us. We live until we die. And I don't know what you mean about veils. There aren't magical things out there that somehow if we uncover them, that poof, we're going to die. That sounds like a false mystical type of a thing. Okay, it doesn't sound like anything I've ever heard. It goes against reason what that statement is. I'm not sure where you heard that quote from, Eros. Okay, so what we're going to do is we'll wrap it up the class now. Okay, A. Rose, why don't you send the question in? Send it by email. All right, you'll see on the left-hand side of your screen, under at the very end of the links, you'll see an envelope icon. You can just click that. That'll send. You can send an email to us, and I'll try to answer you that way. But I just want to reiterate one more time. Okay, A. Rose, I understand. No magic, nothing like that. No problem. But I would like to reiterate one more time for those of you who were not online when we were talking before. You know, in line with the whole concept that God is the first, and everything else is in its existence, comes into existence only because of God, and nothing else has power except for God. So I mentioned earlier that there is a website called Judaism.com, which is promoting this red bindle. They're claiming that it has power. They completely destroy the pristine reputation of our matriarch, Rachel, and they make her gravesite into like an idolatrous tomb. And they take red strings, they wrap it around her grave, and then they say that this red string, if you wear it, will have protective qualities. And it's completely against the Torah philosophy, and they're doing it in the name of Judaism. It's on a site called Judaism.com, and we all have to speak out against such a travesty when Torah is gaining a reputation as being an idolatrous, mystical, Kabbalistic cult type of a thing. I mean, according to Maimonides, he didn't have any Kabbalah. Kabbalah just means received, reception. He didn't have the traditions passed down to him. His statements were what he came up with his own mind. He says this in the beginning of his intro to the third chapter of the Guide for the Perplexed. And he states that he did not have the traditions. So that means it didn't reach him, didn't reach us. So people who claim, and Kabbalah itself was not something that was allowed to be written down. Anything received orally was not allowed to be written down. All they did write down were the Mishnah. That was all that was permitted to be written down. Anything else was not. So if anybody has a book today that claims it to be Kabbalah, by definition, that book can't be Kabbalah because it's now in a written form. So it loses all status of Kabbalah. But just, simply, there's no such thing as protective devices. This is superstition. This is idolatry. This is what all the rabbis warn against. This is what God warns against. And what I asked everybody to do is on the bottom of your right-hand part, again, I'm just speaking that to those of you who joined the class after we did this earlier, but if you look at the bottom of your screen, you'll see the white entry field where you can type in, a message on the chat window. But if you look directly to the right, you'll see a bunch of links. The last link, it says receive schedule, it says invite others. It also says the word activism. I'm asking everybody, click on that activism link, It should open up an email box, and you'll send an email telling Judaism.com that you're boycotting their site, and you're telling others to boycott the site until they remove that promotional video for the Red Bendel, and until they stop selling the Red Bendel. It's completely against the Talmud. That's against all the rabbis. But on top of that, besides clicking that activism link on the bottom right now, I'm asking everybody to please send an email to everybody on your list that is concerned about Jewish issues, and they should write to that website. They should write to info@judaism.com and tell them, and tell all your friends to write an email to them protesting their promotion of idolatry. It's against tractate Sabbath. You could quote that. And it's against the rabbis. It's pure idolatry. And you want to tell them, basically, you're boycotting the site. They have no source in Judaism except for the stupid Jews that are doing this today. That's their source. And to us, that's completely ludicrous. You don't follow what people do. I don't care what the people look like. I don't care if they live night and day at the tomb of Rachel. That does not make a practice proper. All right? The most perfected person sins. All right? Moses made mistakes. We don't say that because a person looks like a Jew and talks like a Jew, that his practices are Jewish. So this is something you have to speak out against. So again, I'm asking everybody to take it seriously, to send an email to your list, to your contacts, and tell them that they should write to info@judaism.com saying that they protest this idolatry of red strings. It's against the Torah. And it's something which you're boycotting their site, and you're telling everybody else to boycott. But we have to do this in numbers, so it's important that a lot of us respond and tell them to just, completely abandon selling red bedels. And we don't care that it's wrapped around Rachel's tomb. We don't care if it's wrapped around Moses' tomb. All right? This is something which is completely idolatrous. Physical objects don't have powers. God is the only thing which has power. If you need the actual, I'm going to type on screen right now the actual email address. So this way you can copy this email address. Okay, I just put it on screen in red. So you have the actual email address. Send this email address to your contacts and tell them that it goes against. I'm going to also write, you can copy this out too. And it's called the Tosefta, which is the statements in the back. Red strings are the ways of Amorites, which is idolatrous. Okay, it's Tractate Sabbath, Tosefta, chapter 7, and it says red strings are the ways of the Amorites, meaning it's idolatry. Right? And you basically want to tell them that you are going to be boycotting their site and telling others to do the same. Okay, so take care of that. We could have a little activism. Whenever we can't speak out against things that mislead people, we should do it. Okay. Okay, let me see any of the questions that we have. Chloe is asking, is that site connected to Jews for Jesus temples? No, unfortunately, that website, Judaism.com, purports to be a mainstream Jewish store. Baruch is saying, stopping Judaism.com is only a small step. That's right, and we have to take whatever step we can. Is there a way to prevent the red string from being put around Rachel's tomb? The problem has been around that longer than Judaism.com. Well, we could start here. There's no reason why we can't take individual steps, Baruch. So we do what we can. If you have other suggestions, feel free to suggest them to other people and to myself as well. I'd be more than happy to hear other suggestions. Okay, Shmuel, you're asking, what is normally the time frame for the classes? Usually an hour and a half, Shmuel. Okay, Baruch is asking, do you also recommend staying away from bookstores that sell books on Hasidus? Yes, if the books have any content which is idolatrous, it doesn't matter whether it's Hasidus or something else. So it's you're not picking a group and labeling everything they do as negative. All right. we have a number of articles that we have on the Masorah site, which condemn certain ideas that Hasidism defends. That doesn't mean that every single thing which Hasidism does is wrong. You have to always deal with an individual issue and see if it matches up with the Torah's principles. Okay. Somebody is asking, is it right for us to tell the other the same? If you mean about the website, yes, you should tell other people to boycott their site, but to email them. Robbie Chico is asking, I thought the red string originated in the book of Joshua and the story of Rahab and the spies. That all that meant, they put a scarlet or a purple thread, they told her, because they were going to wipe out the city of Jericho. So they said, you stay in your house with all your family, since you protected us, because the Jew, the story, Robbie, this is for Robbie, I'm answering you, you're asking if the red string originated in the story of Joshua. No, it did not, because what happened was the Jews went in, Joshua sent in the spies to survey the land, Jericho, because they were going to take it over. And Rahab, this woman who was righteous and recognized the Jewish people as having the right philosophy, protected these spies when the people of Jericho came to hunt them down. So she hid them in the roof on the flax. And when the officers came from the king of Jericho to her house because they heard that they had come, she lied and she protected their lives. So after she sent, hurry up, they ran to the mountains, maybe you can catch them. So after the officers left Rahab's house, so the men, the Jewish men, came out that were sent by Joshua, and she said to them, you know, please save me and my family. I know you're coming to wipe out Jericho, so please save me and my family. So they said to her, we'll save your family on the condition that not one of you steps out of the your house, because whoever steps out of the house, we can't be held responsible. His blood is on his head. And they told her that this will be the symbol. We're going to go back and tell all of our Jewish warriors that the house that has the red ribbon, whatever it was, the red thread, the red ribbon, is an indication that you do not harm this house. You do not go into that house. That's all that was. It was basically a stop sign telling the Jews, this house is where a woman lives and her family. They protected us. They saved our lives. Don't hurt her. Go conquer the rest of the land, but leave the house alone. And the way they signified which house it was with that red string. But that doesn't mean there's any power to the thing. Now, if people later on put a red string around their wrist because they think it's going to protect them and give them wealth, they think it'll stop a bullet from entering their body, or it'll make an infertile woman fertile, that, it's nonsense. There's no, we work with cause and effect, with rational principles. That's what Torah is based on. So that's why it's very important to, wherever we see idolatrous notions like this popping up, we really have to make a statement. Being quiet only allows more people to fall prey, because it's a very attracting idea to have protection in the form of the physical. But that's idolatrous. Okay, let me see other questions. All right, Chaim in Las Vegas, I guess. I was away, so if you answered this, I'm sorry. Why did people come up to us at the Western Wall and put the red string around our wrist and then asked for a donation and said it'll bring us good luck? Okay, Chaim, and I guess that's Las Vegas. Chaim, the reason why people came up to you at the Western Wall and put a string around your wrist and asked for a donation is two reasons. Number one, they're idolatrous people. Number two, they want your money. That's all. Just because you were at the Western Wall, that does not condone any activity that a person does. I don't care if they do it in the name of Judaism. Many things were done in the name of Judaism. All right? I mean, Jesus is an outgrowth in the name of Judaism. Do we say that we accept him because he was Jewish? No. Okay? Our mind tells us what's true. God's Torah tells us what's true. And clearly, when the Talmud says openly that red strings on the hands is the way of the idolatrous people, clearly, I mean, that shows you it's against the Torah. But even if you didn't have that statement that the rabbis in the Talmud, in Tractate Sabbath, your mind will tell you that this is not something which is part of Torah. Nothing we have in the Torah system is said to be a protective device. We pray to God, and that's it. We do not do anything else. Even the mezuzah that we have in the house is just to remind us of the ideas. A mezuzah does not protect the house. The mezuzah is made of a piece of animal skin and black ink. Individually, the animal skin and black ink don't do anything. They have no power. When you put it together and create a mezuzah, they also do not have any power. It's still animal skin and black ink, and even though God's name is on it, there's no protective quality. So if somebody gives you a red bendel and asks you for money, what you respond, you say, no, I do not want your red bendel. Number two, you tell him the source that this is prohibited. And you explain to him how this cannot protect a wicked person. If God's going to punish a wicked person, a red string on his hand is not going to stop God from punishing. And if a person is absolutely righteous, like Moses, right, and he's not wearing a red string, do you think God's going to punish him because he's not wearing a red string? So either way you go, the red string is ridiculous. Okay, A. Rose, okay, I'm glad that you're able to join. Again, keep, now in terms of the future classes, somebody asked, we'll try to do another class this week. So please see the page, the live classes link, and that will tell you that we're going to update that page as to when the next class will be. So, but we'll send an email out. Okay, a few more questions. Not to be in agreement with the red string in any way, but was not the blood of the Passover sacrifice a physical thing that provided protection from death from the angel of death? Or was the protection provided because of obedience? Exactly, Michael, you have the answer. The blood that we put on the doorposts when we were in Egypt, our ancestors did, it was not a protective device. It was blood like any other blood. But what it did was it demonstrated that we will openly deny that the Egyptian calf, that the Egyptian god, has any power. How do we openly deny that the Egyptian's god has any power? First of all, God told them, you take this animal for 4 days. You keep this animal underneath your control for 4 days. You will have to openly display for 4 days that you don't accept the Egyptian's god as a god. This animal is just an animal. That's the first step. The second step, you're going to kill it and put the blood on your doorpost. You'll put it on a public part of the house that anybody would see walking in and out. You're not putting it on a part of your house that's hidden. Another demonstration that you see that what signifies the death of the god of Egypt? The blood. Therefore, they were told, you take this animal, you kill it, and take the blood of this animal and you put it in a public spot, the doorpost of your house, which is where everybody enters and exits. And therefore, it's a public demonstration that you don't look at this god as anything. If you show this, if you make this demonstration and you're convinced that the animal is not God, then God will save you. But not because it's a protective quality. It's merely because you did the right activity which demonstrated your intellectual conviction that this animal is nothing. Okay, Baruch is saying the following. Are you saying that there isn't a connection between doing mitzvahs and getting some reward? No, of course not. But God's the one that gives you a reward. All right, Baruch? There's no power in a mitzvah. All right, that's what we're trying to show over here. There's no such thing as power in a mitzvah. Okay, Mitch Menschel. Thank you. For now, my wife has heard, for the first time in her life, the origin of the red string Bubba Misa. Okay. Okay, Chaim in Las Vegas. My pleasure. I hope you could join the next class. I'm glad you enjoyed it. And again, we will post online the first link. If you look to the left of your screen right now, you'll see there's a bunch of white links. The first one says live classes. Normally that link on the top will blink when we're in session, but I just didn't get around to doing that. We started the class on time. But that live classes link, which is how you got to this class today, that has a schedule. Keep your eyes on that schedule, and then you'll be able to be notified. Also, again, I'm just reminding you one more time to please scroll up for a second. In the main area of the chat window, if you just scroll up just a bit, you'll see the red text that I inserted. And that's the email that you should send to info@judaism.com. And I gave you the quote of where it shows that the red strings are prohibited. and tell them that you boycott. But tell everybody on your list to do this. Ask everybody on your email list to send an email to info@judaism.com and that they're boycotting their site because they're promoting something in the name of Judaism, which is complete lies. All right. Okay, so if there's no other questions, I think we'll wrap it up for today. Let's maybe just go for 5 more minutes here. I see some questions. Sufa Ahava, okay, what are you saying? Says as follows. I was listening to a lecture from age.com, and a rabbi stated that Job is not a real person, more like a parable. Did I misunderstand him? No, that's actually Maimonides' position. Maimonides says that the story of Job is really a story that of a person that really didn't exist, but the ideas are true. Gedalia is asking, thanks for the class. Learned a few different views of Hasidus, okay? Yecheskel Toronto, should we make a connection between mitzvos and reward? Is this sort of making Judaism like an armless program, meaning making it like a just a way to... You really shouldn't be doing it for the reward, because if you're doing the mitzvos, if you're acting out the commands of God, the best way to do it is to learn them, study them, see how they perfect us, and do them because you see that it's a good for us. If you're doing it because you just want some sort of an imagined reward later on, then you really are not doing it for the right reason. And then your reward is going to be absent. I mean, you can't, it's a catch-22. If you try to do the mitzvah just for the reward, then you're not doing the mitzvah for the right reason. So study the mitzvahs, see the ideas behind them, because the most important mitzvah, by the way, the Talmud says openly, the most important mitzvah is learning Torah. That means when our minds are engaged in seeing new truths and appreciating ideas, that's the most important involvement. So that's really something we should be doing. We shouldn't just be going through actions that are blank in our mind just because we're promised reward, because then we're not doing the action properly. We're not really understanding the concept of a mitzvah. That's the most important part of a mitzvah, is the concept. What's the idea behind reading the Megillah that's coming up in Purim? What's the important idea about eating matzah? Let's say I eat matzah, and I drink the wine on Passover. I don't know why I'm doing it, but I just do it because I'm commanded. Well, you have to do it because you're commanded. There's no way out. But in terms of achieving the goal that God wants, that you have true concepts, then you haven't achieved that. That's why you have to study these areas. All right, that's why I think it was Moses who instituted the concept that 30 days before a holiday, you should start investigating the laws of a holiday. Okay, so that should answer your question too, Michael. You're asking, do we do the mitzvahs for the sake of the mitzvah? We have to do the mitzvah because God commanded us. The word mitzvah means command. So yes, we do the 613 commands because they are commanded. That does not mean that should be where it ends. We have to understand them. And no, you can't just pick and choose the ones that you understand, Baruch. You have to do all the mitzvahs. But if there are mitzvahs that you see, don't understand, so learn about them, investigate them. That's what we're doing today. Okay, all right, Gene, thank you very much. I'm glad you enjoyed the class. Okay, so I think we're going to wrap it up at this point. I'm glad everybody was up to join us today. And again, keep your eyes on the schedule. We'll pick up a class. Hopefully we'll do another class during the week. And continue in the fundamentals of Judaism. Okay, so let me wish everybody a good night. I'm glad you enjoyed it. And again, if you've missed any part of the class is recorded, and it will be online in half an hour after the class is over. It'll be in the audio files. So you'll look for fundamentals number 4. That was this class. Okay, so it will be online if you'd like to hear it from the beginning. Elazar, if you have a question, feel free. I'll take a question now if you like. Go ahead. Okay, Gilboa. And I guess that's Canada or California. Okay, Cal. Nice to see you. And Doug, hopefully I'll see you in New York at some point. Maybe at the Fox wedding coming up. Maybe we'll see you out there. And again, if there's any questions that anybody has that we didn't take up during the class, feel free to email them in. Right, Elazar, don't see the question. I'll tell you what, Elazar, why don't you send the email in? Okay, so I'll answer it that way because we are already wrapped up. Okay, Gilboa, California, send that in as the email as well. Okay, so let me wish everybody a good night. If there's any questions, feel free to send them in. Okay, Cal. Okay, Doug, be well. All right, have a good night, everybody. Stay tuned, and we'll see what the next class will be. You'll see them on the schedule on the live classes link. We'll post when the next class will be this week. Okay, have a good night.